911 emergency.
I'm with you. Police.
What's going on?
515th Street.
What's going on there, ma'am?
We have a kidnapping. Hurry, please.
Explain to me what's going on, okay?
There, we have a... There's a note left and our daughter's gone.
A note was left and your daughter is gone?
Yes.
How old is your daughter?
6 years old. She's gone. 6 years old.
How long ago was this?
I don't know. I just found the note. And my daughter's gone.
Does it say who took her?
What?
Does it say who took her?
I don't know. There's a ransom note here.
It's a ransom note?
It says SBTC. Victory. Please.
Okay, what's your name? Are you
Kathy Ramsey? I'm the mother. Oh my God! Please.
I'm sending an officer over. Okay.
Please.
Do you know how long she's been gone?
No, I don't. Please, we just got out, and she's right here. Oh my God! Please.
Okay.
Please, well, somebody.
I am, honey.
Please.
Take a deep breath.
Please.
Away, okay.
Hurry.
Kathy.
Hey everybody, welcome to the inaugural episode of Cold Case Murder Mysteries. I'm your host Ryan Krause, and I'll be rolling solo here as I dive right into an examination of the death of 6-year-old child beauty queen JonBenet Ramsey, who was brutally murdered under mysterious circumstances within the confines of the family's sprawling Boulder, Colorado residence on Christmas night 1996. For anyone who's not already familiar with the case, it's important to note that what initially sparked such immense interest was a series of somewhat provocative videos released by mainstream media in the aftermath of the crime that depicted the little girl as a stunning beauty queen who'd been the winner of numerous pageants. While this was accurate, what many people saw was a very young girl disguised as someone far advanced from her age, and subsequently criticism rained down upon the parents, John and Patsy Ramsey, questioning not only what type of people would allow a small child to be objectified in such a seemingly sexual manner, but also for the fact that it could have drawn forth some type of predator, a pedophile who became obsessed with JonBenet. By their own admission, in an interview, the Ramseys admit to having given JonBenet the moniker, "Our Little Sex Kitten." Two camps of public opinion then seem to create a fork in the road, with one path leading to the theory that Ramseys were perhaps neglectful, but innocent, as an intruder familiar with their daughter from her pageants had clearly come into their home and snatched her during the night before killing her in a sexual assault that went awry. The other road leads to a darker place, as many begin to whisper that perhaps the parents are involved in JonBenet's death. Of course, the family never knew their move from Atlanta to Boulder in the early 1990s would end in such tragedy. With JonBenet and older brother Burke in tow, John and Patsy Ramsey inhabit a gorgeous brick front three-story home at 755 15th Street in Boulder, Colorado, an idyllic town nestled in a valley beneath the Flatirons and the foothills of the Rockies. John, who has two older children, John Andrew and Melinda, from a previous marriage, runs a successful software company called Access Graphics, while Patsy is a former Miss West Virginia turned stay-at-home mom who engineers JonBenet pageant adventures. So, let's start by taking a look back at the timeline of how this transpired. We know the Ramseys attended a Christmas party at the home of their friends Fleet and Priscilla White, and arrived home between 8:30 and 10 that night, more likely on the earlier side of that estimate. What we know for sure is that up until that point, the facts are not disputed. There are no unsubstantiated lies, finger-pointing, or deception to be found. But as soon as the garage door goes down behind the family's SUV, chaos ensues, and it becomes very difficult to separate fact from fiction. Yet, while there truly isn't any way to know exactly what transpired in the shadows of that evening among John, Patsy, Burke, and JonBenet, or even a predator hiding in the dark, at 5:52 a.m. the next morning, this ball of yarn begins to unravel. So let's pick it up right there, at the moment Patsy makes her frantic 911 call. So, Patsy is connected to 911 operator Kim Archuleta, explains there's been a kidnapping and a ransom note was left, but never mentions her daughter's name. She offers JonBenet's age and hair color, while repeatedly making requests for the police to hurry to the house and trying to get off this phone as soon as possible. Now, the operator is attempting to keep her on the phone and calm, but Patsy just decides to hang up as soon as she's blurted out her request. But again, she hangs up without ever giving her daughter's name, or even a description of what she was wearing. Notice that these actions place great importance on the police getting to the house ASAP, and Patsy not answering any more questions on a recorded phone call. But here's where it gets interesting. Patsy doesn't realize she didn't actually hang up the phone. She might have pressed the button to hang it up, but didn't hold it long enough, or perhaps didn't replace the receiver in the cradle. Whatever the case may have been, there was muffled audio left at the end of the call, and Kim Archuleta wisely remains on the line. This comes back into play in 1997, when the tape is submitted to an aerospace company to see if they can lift clear iterations of the words contained within. Apparently, they found that Patsy repeats the words, "Help me, Jesus," before Burke says, "What did you find?" John Ramsey then addresses Burke with, "We're not talking to you." To this day, the Ramseys deny these are their voices at the end of the 911 call. But if they aren't, whose are they? So, now, this is where the Ramseys already find themselves spinning a web of deception. They claim that their 9-year-old son Burke had been asleep all night, and was still asleep at the time of the 911 call, even despite the fact that Patsy says she screamed on the back staircase leading to the kitchen when she found the ransom note. This is significant because Burke later told the police in an interview that he could normally hear the refrigerator door closing in the kitchen from his bedroom, but he doesn't hear this scream, or even John running down the stairs from the third floor to see what's going on. Meanwhile, Patsy tells police two different versions of finding the ransom note, one where she goes in JonBenet's room first and sees she's missing, and then finds the note, while on the other she recalls finding the note first, then going to her daughter's room. Minutes later, at 5:59 a.m., Officer Rick French is the first cop to arrive on the scene, and he finds this note. "Mr. Ramsey, listen carefully. We are a group of individuals that represent a small foreign faction. We respect your business, but not the country that it serves. At this time, we have your daughter in our possession. She is safe and unharmed, and if you want her to see 1997, you must follow our instructions to the letter. You will withdraw $118,000 from your account. $100,000 will be in $100 bills, and the remaining $18,000 in $20 bills. Make sure that you bring an adequate size attaché to the bank. When you get home, you will put the money in a brown paper bag. I will call you between 8 and 10 a.m. tomorrow to instruct you on delivery. The delivery will be exhausting, so I advise you to be rested. If we monitor you getting the money early, we might call you early to arrange an earlier delivery of the money and hence a earlier pickup of your daughter. Any deviation of my instructions will result in the immediate execution of your daughter. You will also be denied her remains for proper burial. The two gentlemen watching over your daughter do not particularly like you, so I advise you to not provoke them. Speaking to anyone about your situation, such as police, FBI, etc., will result in your daughter being beheaded. If we catch you talking to a stray dog, she dies. If you alert bank authorities, she dies. If the money is in any way marked or tampered with, she dies. You will be scanned for electronic devices, and if any are found, she dies. You can try to deceive us, but be warned that we are familiar with law enforcement countermeasures and tactics. You stand a 99% chance of killing your daughter if you try to outsmart us. Follow our instructions and you stand a 100% chance of getting her back. You and your family are under constant scrutiny, as well as the authorities. Don't try to grow a brain, John. You are not the only fat cat around, so don't think the killing will be difficult. Don't underestimate us, John. Use that good southern common sense of yours. It is up to you now, John. Victory. Signed, SBTC. Okay, so conflicting reports have French searching the house before or after reading that ransom note. But ultimately, this search takes him to the basement of the family's home. As he passes a closed door to a dusty old wine cellar that is latched from the outside, he pauses, but keeps on going, finding a broken window with a suitcase nearby. In a later statement, Officer French claimed he did not open the door to the wine cellar because protocol was for him to search for a point of exit for an intruder, given that the circumstance was presented as a kidnapping, and the latch was on the wrong side of the door for it to lead outside. Still, I think good sense says you just open the door anyway, given that there's a missing person involved, and the man clearly regretted it when a debacle ensued in the absence of taking such action. Meanwhile, family friends John and Barbara Fernie arrive, followed by Fleet and Priscilla White. Patsy called them right after the 911 call and asked them to come by. Fleet searches the basement by himself 15 minutes later and claims the lights were already on down there, including in the hallway outside the wine cellar door. So, unlike Officer French, Fleet uses common sense and opens the door. But he can't see anything inside. It's too dark, even with the light from where he's standing in the hallway. He reaches inside the doorway, but can't find a light switch, so he shuts the door. At this point, John Ramsey is upstairs calling his personal pilot, Michael Archuleta, about getting out of Dodge and heading to Atlanta. I find it really interesting that the person they called to get the police to their home was Kim Archuleta, and the person they called to get out of their home away from the police was Michael Archuleta. No relation, of course. Remember, supposedly John's daughter has been kidnapped, and the family was previously scheduled to fly to Charlevoix, Michigan for a vacation that morning. But here he is already rerouting his plans across the country while waiting for his daughter's kidnapper to call in Colorado. So, more officers arrive at the scene. Forensics people are being dispatched to the location, as well as Boulder Police Detective Linda Arndt. But before she arrives, a small team of victims' advocates shows up with bagels and coffee, stomping all over the crime scene and sprucing up the kitchen, even wiping down the counters with spray cleaner. Then their reverend shows up. It's officially a party. And finally, 9-year-old Burke is awakened. You know, because his mother screaming, his father running down the stairs, a frantic 911 call, police searching the house, his voice on a 911 call, and the arrival of at least 10 other people in the kitchen would not have stirred Burke, who, in his words, could normally hear the refrigerator door closing in the kitchen from his bedroom. So, sometime during these events of 7 to 9 a.m., John Ramsey decides to search the basement. According to him, this was after Fleet White's search, but he said there was a chair blocking the door to the hallway leading to the wine cellar. Yet we already know Fleet searched this area before him, so the chair wouldn't be blocking the doorway. Ramsey then suggests maybe it was before Fleet performed his search, but Officer French was the first responder at 5:59 a.m. and didn't encounter the blocked doorway. So it stands to reason that the search John Ramsey reported to police was actually completed in the 7 minutes after the 5:52-911 call before Officer French arrived. In this instance, it seems less like somebody doing a thorough search for his daughter, and more so like somebody taking a last-second look at his work to be sure he didn't make any mistakes. Some proponents of the theory that Patsy killed JonBenet in a fit of rage while John slept believe this is the moment where he might have found the body, realized what his wife did, and had no choice but to play along or he would lose a lot more than just his daughter. So, the Ramsey parents spend the majority of that day separated from one another and in different rooms, leading many to believe there was some type of rift or disagreement boiling beneath the surface. Then, at 8:10 a.m., Boulder Police Detective Linda Arndt arrives and is briefed by Officer French. She immediately begins taking notes regarding the Ramsey's behavior, and her initial impression of John is simply cordial in his demeanor. He doesn't seem to be upset. In fact, when he goes to the kitchen and opens his mail in a nonchalant manner, she's right there taking notes. And to this point, these are just notations, little oddities that may or may not be significant. But then this happens. The 8 to 10 a.m. time period in which the kidnapper was supposed to call, according to the ransom note, passes without so much as a word from the parents. But Arndt doesn't mention this to them. She just observes. I mean, if your daughter is missing, why are you not leaning over the phone with wide eyes and eager hands ready to snatch it up at the first sign of a ring? And if it doesn't ring, why aren't you worried that it hasn't? Meanwhile, JonBenet's bedroom is finally sealed off as a crime scene, but the rest of the house is turned into a circus. By 10:30 a.m., however, the crowd has been reduced to Linda Arndt, the Ramseys, and their friends. Everything seems to be under control. But that's when the FBI arrives and swarms the home. A little more than 2 hours later, around 1 p.m., the forensics team leaves, which is absolutely dreadful timing considering what happens next. Linda Arndt notices John Ramsey becoming restless, so she asks Fleet White to take him on a top-to-bottom search of the house to keep his mind occupied, a decision she'll later regret. Now, according to some sources, John led the way down to the basement immediately and beelined to the wine cellar door. This is actually not true by his account or even Fleet White's. They first approached the broken window in the area where the suitcase had been found, then checked the closet before John approached the wine cellar door 5 to 10 minutes into the search. Now, here's where the eventual rift between close friends Fleet White and John Ramsey begins to take flight. According to John, he opens the wine cellar door, turns on the light, because unlike Fleet, of course, he would know its location because it's his house, and sees JonBenet lying on the floor, wrapped in a white blanket. Conversely, by Fleet's account, John opened the door and cried out at the sight of his dead daughter before he turned on the light. As Fleet had already opened the door to this windowless room and learned that you couldn't see inside without turning on a light, he presumed John must have already known the body was inside. Either way, the scene is not pretty. In fact, it's a far cry from the beauty we see in JonBenet's pageant videos. The little girl's hands are bound above her head with nylon cord. And that same cord is being used as the ligature and garrote mechanism cranked tightly around her neck to strangle her. It's a setup that seems to initially indicate the crime was sexual in nature. And while there's barely any blood, what they can't see at this point is an 8.5-inch fracture that runs the length of JonBenet's skull, originating from a point of impact that leaves an oval-shaped depressed fracture near the back of her head. One that seems to have been left by a cylindrical object of some kind, like the head of a flashlight, or perhaps even the heel of a golf club. Anyhow, John immediately drops to his daughter's side, rips a strip of black duct tape from her mouth, and carries her upstairs into the living room, where she's ultimately placed next to the Christmas tree. Detective Linda Arndt is standing there with jaw dropped at this point. I mean, she says this is the moment where she sees John Ramsey enter the room carrying the body, and all the pieces of the puzzle suddenly fit together in this epiphany that just absolutely blows her mind. So she kneels next to the body on the other side of John Ramsey, where they peer down over the victim in silence. In the background, Patsy is wailing like an animal as she's brought into the room to see JonBenet. But at that moment, John Ramsey and Linda Arndt look up from the body and into each other's eyes. They're face to face, and the detective says at that moment she looked into his gaze and knew exactly who the killer was. She says she tucked one arm closer to her shoulder holster and wondered if any of them were going to get out of that house alive that day. Moreover, she claims she knows who the killer is, but will never speak that person's name, nor does she think that the murderer will ever face prosecution. And with that notion, I think it's probably fair to note the fact that minors below the age of 10 cannot be prosecuted for crimes in Colorado, where this took place. Burke Ramsey was 9 years old at the time of the incident. More on that later. So, Linda Arndt calls in a code black, essentially signifying that the kidnapping is now a murder. Meanwhile, somebody contaminates the body even further by placing a blanket over it, as well as a Colorado Avalanche sweatshirt. Minutes later, Sergeant Larry Mason arrives and decides to secure the house as a crime scene, nearly 8 hours after the 911 call is made. 20 minutes later, John Ramsey continues his earlier conversation with his personal pilot and tells him to get the plane ready to head to Atlanta. This is overheard by police, specifically Detective Bill Palmer, who basically says, "No chance, buddy." So the Ramseys decide to stay at a friend's place. And this is right about the time that their attorney friend Mike Bynum sees the writing on the wall and advises them to lawyer up. So John Ramsey goes for a walk with John Fernie in the Boulder foothills, and when he comes back a half hour later, he hires Bynum as representation. So as things begin to calm back at the house, the crowd once again thins with the FBI leaving and the body getting ready for transport. Things are winding down, but somebody notices a large black flashlight that's been sitting on the kitchen counter all day unclaimed. It looks like a police flashlight at first glance, but it's not, and none of the officers ever claim it. So it gets photographed and taken into evidence, where we learn that it was not only purchased by John's oldest son, John Andrew, as a gift to the Ramseys, but that somebody wiped down the outside of it. There were no fingerprints found on it. And when they checked the batteries inside for the same, it was revealed they had also been wiped clean. Not coincidentally, the depressed fracture on JonBenet's head is a perfect match for a cylindrical object of that size striking a spherical object such as her skull. So, at 10:45 p.m. on the evening of December 26, 1996, JonBenet Ramsey's body is finally removed from the home, and right behind her, the door closes as Detective Linda Arndt is the last to leave that night. She walks out into a firestorm of controversy and criticism that would derail her career and fuel decades of speculation that her actions directly impacted the ability of the Boulder Police Department to properly handle the case. Now, the Ramseys remain somewhat cooperative throughout the day of the 26th, and even speak to police at times during the days of the 27th and 28th. But in the aftermath of these interactions, it becomes clear that the police are not just considering them suspects, but are only looking at them. At this point, they turtle up for months in the relative comfort of high-priced legal protection, and the result is the communication ultimately breaks down completely. From January through April, there is no contact between the two parties, and the Ramseys have still not been formally interviewed. In the meantime, however, things get ugly. In what was supposed to be a routine trip into the sealed-off Ramsey home slash crime scene to get funeral clothes for the family, Patsy's sister, Pam Paul, engages in an evidence grab that sees numerous items leave the house that were never approved and were not relevant to the funeral. Many proponents of the Ramsey's did it theory believe this is when remaining evidence from the cover-up was removed, but I personally believe such evidence was all likely discarded by way of scissors and a flushing toilet. It's hard to say. Then, in an audacious turn of events, the Boulder mayor starts the first week of January 1997 with a stunning press conference that suggests the people of Boulder have nothing to worry about, that there isn't some monster out on the loose hunting children, essentially blaming the parents outright, consistent with the feelings of the police department. Caught in the middle is DA Alex Hunter, who's getting heavy pressure from the police to look closely at the Ramseys, while also getting the same pressure from wealthy political ties in the community that want to squash even the notion of such a thing taking place in their perfect town. So, a few weeks later, on January 13th, Burke Ramsey is interviewed by child psychologist Dr. Suzanne Bernard, supposedly with the permission of the Ramseys, but some claim the police did not have permission and simply told the person babysitting Burke at the time that they did. Either way, the videotaped interview is ultimately made public, and its contents are somewhat disturbing. In it, the doctor makes note of his lack of emotion and how Burke feels, quote, safe, even though there's a killer on the loose who already got his sister. She asks him what he thinks happened the night of her death, and he says, quote, I know what happened. He then laughs nervously and holds a plastic toy in front of his face to conceal himself. As a matter of opinion, I watched this video and was less disturbed by his answers than I was by his indifference and casual attitude toward everything except the manner in which he believes his sister might have been hit over the head with a hammer. He puts down the toy that has been shielding his insecurities and firmly demonstrates how the killer would have swung the murder weapon. In this moment, he shows conviction, physical coordination, and intent that immediately contrasts the goofy, squirming, and almost infantile demeanor he represents during the rest of the questioning. What is it that has piqued his interest? Why is there so much more confidence in this demonstrative action, even enough to diminish his insecurities to the point he momentarily forgets them? From my perspective, it's because he doesn't have to sell the psychologist on this point. Basically, it's because he's telling the truth, even if indirectly. Simply put, That's how Burke really did hit his sister with a heavy object. Maybe even a flashlight with no fingerprints found on the kitchen counter after the murder. I mean, everything else he's telling the doctor about the situation is deceptive. So he experiences deep levels of anxiety while performing and trying to sell the act as he's been instructed. The swing is not a lie, however. It therefore does not necessitate the squirming, hiding, and placing the toy in front of his face. Now, it's important to note that Burke will finally be interviewed by police 18 months later. And in that video, we see an older, more sophisticated version of Burke who's still seemingly very immature for his age. And in this video, he's being prompted about what would become the centerpiece of evidence in the case, one that can establish a timeline that would expose the Ramseys as liars. They claim they took JonBenet straight to bed Christmas night when they got home from the party, and never saw her alive again. Essentially, JonBenet's autopsy reveals she had a chunk of pineapple in her small intestine that had been consumed 45 minutes to 2 hours prior to her death, and photo evidence from the Ramseys' kitchen table on December 26, 1996 proves that there was a bowl of pineapple soaked in milk sitting there next to a glass of tea. The coroner who did her autopsy stated that the blow to the head happened first, and then the strangulation finished her off sometime later. In this context, it's not difficult for us to see that JonBenet suffered the initial blow right after consuming the pineapple, and her digestive tract basically provides the timeline moving forward to her death. This would debunk an intruder killing her in the middle of the night as the family slept, and place the initial incident at a time shortly after their arrival home from the White's party. So, all of the Ramseys staunchly deny preparing the snack, or even eating it. Yet Burke's fingerprints are on the bowl and glass, while Patsy's are on the bowl. In the aforementioned police interview with Burke, he squirms all over the place while leaning very far forward in his seat, exuding anxiety as he's shown a bowl of this pineapple. He claims to recognize the bowl as belonging to the Ramseys, but also says he doesn't know what's inside it, even after confirming pineapples and milk is his favorite snack. He pores over the picture and suggests one chunk of the substance looks too big to be cereal. He even confirms that JonBenet loved pineapple too, but still can't identify his favorite snack in a bowl that he recognizes that has his fingerprints on it. To be fair, however, Patsy's explanation for this is that she and Burke often emptied the dishwasher together, even though the family had a housekeeper for such duties, and the fingerprints were obviously a result of that activity, according to her. The Ramseys have always suggested that the intruder likely lured JonBenet with the pineapple, while proponents of a Ramsey cover-up think they have no choice but to deny any knowledge of it. Now, getting back to the rift between the Ramseys and Boulder Police Department, something has to give. So, in April 1997, after months of silence, or preparation, depending on your perspective, the Ramseys are ready to talk. So John writes a letter to Boulder District Attorney Alex Hunter in April 1997 stating such, but with some interesting caveats. And for everybody wondering when this story was going to allow the Ramseys to be indulged for being white, wealthy, and beyond suspicion due to these factors, that time has arrived. This is when John Ramsey and his attorneys inform Alex Hunter that they refuse to be interviewed by the Boulder Police Department. And, get this, they want copies of all of the police reports first. Yes, that's right. The prime suspects in a murder case want to know what the police know before they talk. Like they're studying for a test. Of course, you'd have to think Alex Hunter would balk at such an outrageous demand. But you'd be wrong. He agreed. And here's the thing. It didn't help. The pressure from the Boulder Police Department continued. Public scrutiny increased. This was a national story, and only getting bigger. Something had to be done. So, in 1998, a grand jury assembled to weigh the evidence against John and Patsy Ramsey. And once it had convened, in October 1999, DA Alex Hunter holds a carefully worded press conference that confirms there was not enough evidence to move forward in prosecuting the Ramseys. In the decade that follows, the case fizzles out, and is reduced to the widespread internet speculation of amateur sleuths cracking eggs against the rims of their toilets trying to reenact the wrath of Patsy Ramsey as it might have happened. JonBenet goes from iconic to legendary, her face surely one that will never be forgotten among the vast lore of American tragedies. And then, in 2006, Patsy Ramsey finally succumbs to cervical cancer after being in remission for some time. It's reported that Linda Arndt shows up at her bedside during this time, befriends Patsy, and perhaps even retracts her belief that the Ramseys were involved in the death of their daughter. Of course, we'll never know. But then, in 2008, Boulder DA Mary Lacey steps out in public with a statement that she's exonerating the Ramseys entirely based upon male-touch DNA found on JonBenet in the aftermath of the crime. This is widely considered to have been a political move that politely shut the door on the case and allowed everybody to move forward, rather than concrete, full-profile DNA from any specific person who might have been involved in the crime. So, this is where proponents of the Ramseys Did It camp began to get discouraged. It seemed they truly would get away with the crime, that privilege had reared its ugly head once again. Until a reporter came to understand that it was possible to have the grand jury documents unsealed after the fact, once a certain date had passed. So in 2013, the general public finally got to see confirmation of what they had believed all along. The evidence against the Ramseys in the 1998 grand jury proceedings handed down indictments recommending two charges for both parents. This bolstered the claim of former Boulder detective Steve Thomas, who said he quit the force in 1998, only one day after hearing Hunter suggest that the case was a political matter and he'd have to go to his people to see if it was okay to assemble a grand jury to look at the Ramseys. Of course, Alex Hunter is not, to this day, obligated or even permitted to respond regarding his lies, as the nature of the grand jury proceedings legally prevents him from divulging information. So, we might never know the extent of the lies and deceit perpetrated by the DA's office, but we know this for sure. The grand jury indicted John and Patsy Ramsey on two charges each, specifically child abuse resulting in death and being an accessory to a crime in the passing of their daughter, JonBenet Ramsey. They are accused of allowing a child to be, quote, unreasonably placed in a situation which posed a threat of injury to the child's life or health, which resulted in the death of JonBenet Ramsey, end quote, and offered assistance to a person, quote, knowing the person assisted has committed and was suspected of the crime of murder in the first degree and child abuse resulting in death. Please notice that neither parent has been recommended to receive a charge of murder, which is necessary to include in Colorado if, in fact, they are being accused of such. But notice it is not included. So if neither Ramsey parent is the murderer, but each is accused of assisting the murderer, the logical conclusion is that Burke Ramsey murdered his sister JonBenet, and his parents covered it up. But did the grand jury get it right? Did 9-year-old Burke Ramsey murder his sister on Christmas night in 1996? Or does a renowned detective brought onto the case prove it was an intruder all along? Let's take a look at the suspects, starting with the intruder theory. This was proposed by legendary Colorado Springs detective Lou Smith. It basically proposes that on the night of December 25th, 1996, a predator familiar with JonBenet through her pageants waited for the Ramseys to go to the White's Christmas party, then entered the home by lifting a grate off a basement window well and unlocking a window with a broken pane that John Ramsey himself had smashed months earlier when he got locked out of the house. Supposedly, the intruder then waits in the basement for the family to arrive, and once they're asleep in bed, he makes his way up to the kitchen, writes the ransom note, and then goes to JonBenet's room where he subdues her with a taser, leaving the two marks later found on her lower back that have become such a huge point of contention regarding their source. At this point, the killer carries her limp body downstairs, catching tinsel from the back staircase in her hair along the way to prove it happened like that. Of course, now you have to believe that, with a body in his arms, he was able to skip the step on which he placed the ransom note so as to not crush it. It then proceeded to the basement where he took JonBenet into the wine cellar to sexually assault her. When she fought back, and perhaps screamed, he hits her over the head with a heavy object and kills her. At this point, he flees the house through the basement window and is never seen again. Okay, It's plausible, but not realistic. Questions arise, such as, why was the nylon cord used to restrain JonBenet loose everywhere except her neck? What sexual predator who derives pleasure from restraints would intentionally tie them so that they allowed freedom of movement? Why were practice versions of the ransom note composed on other pages of the notebook? Why was the pen used to write it placed back in the cup holder? Why was the notebook returned to its original spot? Why is it that all of the materials used in the supposed sexual act came from Patsy's paint tray in the basement? And why was that tray full of fibers from the coat Patsy wore the night of the murder? Tasers do not knock people out cold and leave them that way. They are not intended to subdue people in that manner. JonBenet's injury on her lower back did not match any taser marks, nor is using a taser for this purpose even reasonable. She would most likely leap out of bed screaming if prodded with one. It's an electrical shock, not a heavy dose of Xanax. So, moving on. Why was there mucus on the back of the duct tape used to, quote, silence JonBenet? That indicates she was already dead, or at least out cold from a massive head wound at the time it was placed. Why were fibers from Patsy's coat all over the sticky side of that same piece of duct tape? And when the strange black duct tape seemed to be a match for the duct tape placed over the battery compartment in JonBenet's American Girl doll, why is it that the doll suddenly disappeared, even though the BPD wanted it, only to have those same police intercept a brand new one sent to John's company, Access Graphics, the first week of January 1997, with no name on it and paid for with a money order? Why did John desperately want his bag of golf clubs out of the house, even though it was winter in Colorado and the cops already told him to not leave town for Atlanta? Why is it that Patsy is the only person who was never eliminated by experts as the person who wrote the ransom note? Why is it that she visibly altered her handwriting for police samples in the aftermath? Why is it that all three family members are present on the 911 call, but Patsy and John claim Burke was asleep? Why is it that Ramsey's persist in this denial even though the audio debunks their claims? Still, even with all these lingering questions, and many more to accompany them, the case remains unsolved to this day. So, in the second half of our show, I want to take a closer look at the suspects, including all of your favorites, and maybe some you don't know. So we'll get started here with some gentlemen who would fit the profile of the intruder theory. First up, John Mark Carr. In 2006, this dude confessed to the killing while in Thailand and was subsequently arrested. But it was soon apparent he was only trying to escape the possibility of being charged for other crimes and doing time in a Thai prison. I mean, who could blame him? I'd probably say I shot JFK if it got me out of hard time in a foreign jail. Next up, Gary Oliva. This suspect was suggested by Detective Lou Smith, who claimed the registered sex offender was a pedophile and had been near the Ramsey home on the night of the murder. Smith also alleged that Oliva attended a candlelight vigil for JonBenet at the home the year after her murder. Supposedly, he called a friend after the crime and said, quote, he'd done something horrible. He was eventually arrested in the year 2000 with a photo of JonBenet on his person, in addition to a poem called Ode to JonBenet. He was never charged in the matter, however, and denies any involvement in the crime. He was apparently later arrested on charges of child pornography, but this was unrelated to the Ramsey case. Next up is Michael Helgoff. Known for being predisposed to violence and sexual abuse, Helgoff supposedly told a friend that he and a business partner would be making $50,000 to $80,000 each around the time JonBenet was murdered. But while there was never any serious interest in him as a suspect, strangely, he was found dead of a self-inflicted gunshot wound only 2 days after then-Boulder DA Alex Hunter famously stared at the TV cameras with the notion that they were narrowing the list of suspects and soon there will only be you. Now, what makes this really interesting is that Helgoth apparently owned a pair of high-tech boots, and a partial boot print found in the wine cellar by JonBenet's body at the Ramsey's house was revealed to be that brand. Yet, two other people also involved owned such boots. One was an FBI agent present on the first day of the investigation. And the other? Burke Ramsey. But even though Burke's had recently been purchased, nobody could ever seem to find them. Next up is journalist Chris Wolf. While never a serious suspect from an evidentiary standpoint, the Ramseys pointed a finger at him in their book after his girlfriend suggested he never returned home the night of the murder and was tattered looking and disheveled when he finally did the next morning. Wolf filed a $50 million libel suit against the Ramseys in the aftermath, but it was eventually dropped. And finally, my favorite intruder, one suggested by John Ramsey himself. Santa Claus. Yes, that's right, my friends. Old John told police that family friend Bill McReynolds, who had portrayed the jolly fat man at a gathering just prior to JonBenet's death, had taken quite a liking to the girl. As you might imagine, this lead never panned out. In fact, none of these did. So here we're left with only the heavy hitters, the people who were in the house that night, John, Patsy, and Burke. And to start this off, I want to share something from John Andrew Ramsey. He suggested in a police interview, when asked who he thought the killer might be, that the person would have to be someone who knows the family intimately because, aside from themselves, only close friends knew they used the back spiral staircase where the ransom note was found, instead of the main staircase. So, first up here, John Ramsey. Why he didn't do it? John has no documented temper or history of violence. He's had three daughters and has never been accused of sexual abuse, even though JonBenet had an unusual number of gynecologist visits for a young girl that would suggest something wasn't quite right. And a coroner also suggested prior sexual abuse before the night of the murder. Also, no strength of motive in comparison to other family members. John didn't experience Burke's purported jealousy, nor did he find himself frustrated with JonBenet's bedwetting because Patsy was the person to clean after it. John's demeanor has always been calm, and his intent to deceive has been subtler than Patsy's. This could indicate a disproportionate amount of guilt, and we'll touch on that more when we get to Patsy. Finally, it's important to stress that the 1998 grand jury did not recommend a charge of murder for John in a case where they would have been legally obligated to do so if, in fact, that's what they believed. So, moving on, why John Ramsey did it? As a successful businessman and known entity in the community, John had a reputation that could not survive allegations of sexual abuse from his young daughter. If it was taking place, and he felt immediately threatened that she was going to expose him, either to Patsy or otherwise, it's possible one of these incidents gone awry could have led to a spontaneous act of murder. Next, the golf clubs. They matched the wound. They were removed from the house under suspicious circumstances. There's no way to substantiate anything here, but it's at least worth reiterating that the depressed fracture in JonBenet's head seems to fit the heel of a golf club. And if there's any question as to how the club could be swung from overhead in an enclosed space, it should be noted that the Ramseys also owned junior clubs intended for Burke. Beyond this, there isn't much to suggest John Ramsey committed the act of murder. So, we move along to his wife, Patsy Ramsey. Let's look at why she didn't do it. By all accounts, and for any of her flaws, Patsy was known as a loving mother who regularly expressed affection for her children. She invested a lot of time in JonBenet, especially with her pageants, and as a former beauty queen, she seemed to live vicariously through the little girl. It's hard to imagine that a routine bedwetting incident would cause her to strike her child in the head so hard that she split her skull. An incidental fall during a disagreement would be much more likely. Yet the injuries to JonBenet suggest a blow directly to the head with a handheld object would be the only way to generate the force required to inflict that type of damage. Would a doorknob split a skull in half? Or a toilet rim? Maybe even the edge of a bathtub? Perhaps. But go pick up a large metal flashlight, grip it in your hand a moment, and then consider what the truth might be. Next, if the brutal killing took place during a sexual act, it's even far more likely a woman did not commit the crime. This basically excuses Patsy. Finally, just as with her husband, the grand jury did not deem her worthy of the charge of murder. But hold on a minute here. Let's take a closer look at why Patsy Ramsey did it. A minute ago, We were willing to give Patsy the benefit of the doubt regarding JonBenet's bedwetting combined with holiday stress pushing her to the point of murdering her prized daughter. So let's not be so hasty in that context. What if it did push her over the edge? Friends said Patsy had confided in them that she was having a tough time that Christmas season, and the Ramsey's housekeeper said she would often arrive early in the morning to find the sheets from JonBenet's bed tumbling in the dryer, indicating there had been a bedwetting accident during the night. And what was less known during the early years of the investigation, at least to the public, is that Burke used to wet the bed as well during this time. This is something he lied about to a child psychologist, who suggested most children tell the truth in these situations. In fact, it was known he had this issue, even at 9. So, I think we have to ask ourselves how much Patsy could realistically take before she snapped. For many parents in the world, that's not even a bad day. But for a well-to-do former beauty queen trying to live a charmed life that gets derailed on a daily basis, maybe it is. I don't know. On that note, however, former Boulder detective Steve Thomas suggested that Patsy was likely the guilty party, and it was due to a bedwetting accident that culminated in an argument in the little girl's bathroom. Long story short, JonBenet ends up getting shoved into something like the edge of the bathtub or the toilet rim. And given the fact that JonBenet's head injury did not result in a bloody mess, it's perfectly conceivable that the crime did in fact take place in that location, which was predominantly white porcelain and a tile floor. Perhaps the strongest piece of circumstantial evidence for this theory is a police photo from December 26 showing an open bag of diapers hanging halfway out of a cabinet door outside JonBenet's bedroom in the hallway, as though they'd been hastily yanked from inside, and with no regard for how they were left. Next up is fiber evidence, which we touched upon earlier. The coat Patsy wore the night of the murder, as well as the next day, was found to have left fibers on JonBenet's body, on the back of the duct tape covering her mouth, and in the paint tray used to construct the garrote and ligature. Oh, and about that sexual torture device that was constructed with the nylon cord. You know, the one from Patsy's paint tray. When the Ramseys finally turned over their credit card history, one of Patsy's receipts for $2.29 was traced to a hardware store on a hunch that the single item in question might be the nylon cord used to strangle JonBenet. And it was. Next, the ransom note. In my eyes, the reason this note is unlike any experts have ever seen is that it fits this description, as far as its writer. Maternal in nature, perhaps a mother or even a grandmother, has not kidnapped anyone before, has never written a ransom note or even seen one, is trying to create a distraction, and needs to sell this note as genuine because, even though the victim is technically still only missing when it's written, the writer knows better. This looks less like the work of a kidnapper or a killer, and more like the work of a con artist. And not a very good one at that. In it, we find the phrase, and hence, without any supporting punctuation, which is really quite rare in terms of the possibility of its inclusion in a ransom note. But a 1997 Christmas card written by Patsy Ramsey on the website contains the phrase written in exactly that manner. And while there was never a conclusive match by experts between her handwriting and the ransom note, it isn't difficult to A, see the similarities, and more importantly, B, see where she tries to deceive authorities when comparing her handwriting samples from before the crime to those after. I would venture to say some coaching took place in the legal process, but certainly we can only speculate about this. This I'll say for sure. I believe Patsy did not write this letter with her dominant hand, and it's a safe assumption she was wearing a glove, sandwich wrap, or similar. But back to the writing. When I place a writing instrument in my right hand, with my left being the dominant one, my attempts to draw straight lines within letters have a tendency to lean like malnourished trees. It's a trait I noticed over the years as a student when people would try to write with their non-dominant hands. We find these nuances littered throughout the ransom note, and if you remove them, what's left looks just like Patsy's handwriting from prior to the crime. Now again, this is speculation, so please don't take any of these statements to the bank. But if you do, make sure you bring an adequate size attaché. And, in the 911 call, Patsy never mentions JonBenet's name, even though she's the only reason for calling, which is consistent with the ransom note, which never mentions JonBenet's name, even though she's the one who's been kidnapped. In fact, it doesn't mention Patsy either. It only mentions John, and is specifically addressed to him. Yet, the letter finishes by saying it's up to him now, and reminds him to use that good Southern common sense of his. The closest we get to a mention of JonBenet's name in the ransom note is, quote, your daughter, which is as close as Patsy gets in the 911 call when reporting the kidnapping of their, quote, daughter. Moving forward, it's also true that Patsy has the closest physical ties to the murder, and one could easily speculate she played a far more active role than her spouse. She made the 911 call, couldn't be eliminating as authoring the ransom note, lied about serving the bowl of pineapple when her fingerprints were on the bowl, the paint tray, and its contents were hers, and she bought the nylon cord used to strangle JonBenet. Even if she isn't guilty of the murder, I believe she's responsible for staging a sexual assault in an effort to conceal another person's actions. Finally, her sister Pam Paul, again, is the person who conducted the alleged evidence grab from the Ramsey home when she took numerous items without permission of police. If John Ramsey was guilty of the murder, with a motive of sexual abuse, would she have taken such a risk? So, that's why I think Patsy did it. Except, once again, I really don't. Is it plausible that she killed her daughter during an argument that spun out of control? Yes. But I think what's more likely is Patsy's sentiment from after the crime when she remarked that she would do anything to make sure nothing happened to Burke. And that's what she did. A mother's love is truly that strong. And now we get to the truth. Burke Ramsey killed his sister JonBenet. But first, to be fair, let's cast some doubt over this. Let's look at perhaps why Burke didn't do it. DNA evidence has exonerated the family, no matter how inconclusive or controversial it might be, and given that it came from a contaminated crime scene that is suspected of being staged in the first place. Next, his age. Murder isn't unheard of for young children, but it's still rare for a sibling to kill another when both are under the age of 10 and come from a privileged family. A history of violence. While the Ramseys cast some suspicion on their son by refusing to release his medical records, we're not aware of a violent past or any incident subsequent to JonBenet's death that would raise a red flag. While some claim he hit his sister in the face with a golf club, there seems to be some consensus that perhaps it was just an accident that took place when he motioned into a backswing without seeing her approaching behind him. Also, while most agree Burke's voice appears at the end of the 911 call, nobody has ever been able to find any cracks in this story of him being asleep all night and knowing nothing. He's claimed ignorance since day one. Furthermore, he's offered to take a lie detector test. While he hasn't substantiated this claim with any type of action to this point, it's interesting he would even mention it, given that he has pending lawsuits seeking millions of dollars in damages that could potentially be affected by any negative results, regardless of their admissibility in court. I don't envision a scenario where his legal team allows it, unless it involves prepackaged questions and a handpicked interrogator. So, here we get to why Burke did it. Jealousy is a very powerful motive. So, regardless of any other factors, JonBenet's death was not simply an argument over a piece of pineapple that went horribly wrong. She was a star from day one, and ripped the rug right out from underneath Burke in terms of the attention she got from Patsy. With John working most of the time, Burke's jealousy began to grow in his perceived isolation. JonBenet had awards, talent, expectations placed upon her, and even the physical presence of a beautiful woman on stage. For all intents and purposes, she was everything Burke was not. He was awkward, shy, and supposedly had Asperger's syndrome, which is now part of the spectrum of autistic disorders. He struggled with certain social interactions, and certainly his medical records were withheld to dispel such issues. Now, look, I know what you're thinking. I'm thinking it too. But that doesn't mean he murdered his sister, does it? I can believe that he was jealous, but was he really that angry? And this is the part where I tell you the police discovered he had wiped feces all over JonBenet's bedroom walls and one of her Christmas presents only the night before the murder. In fact, it wasn't the first time. At the risk of making you gag, I'll say that he once supposedly left a softball-sized mound of feces in JonBenet's bed. Now, you tell me how he felt about his sister. Is this something you do to somebody you like? And now give some more thought to the story about JonBenet getting hit with a golf club. Are you still inclined to believe it was an accident? Because we can see this much is true. He didn't want her to live that fairy tale life, the one we saw in the videos. And I believe, in one moment of intense anger that was precipitated by JonBenet snatching his pineapple and swallowing it, he didn't want her to live at all. And he snapped. He hit her in the head with the flashlight, or perhaps the golf club. And like I said before, it wasn't about the pineapple. If you look at the nature of what she did, the reason it was so offensive is because it paralleled Burke's greatest wound, the fact that JonBenet stole their mother's love and attention when she was born. And the manner in which it parallels that dreadful scenario for him is that JonBenet invaded his personal space and took something else from him that he could never get back. Even if it was only a piece of pineapple she swallowed, the symbolic implications are very strong in his mind. She was basically saying that everything belongs to her, and in that moment, he wanted to put a stop to her and didn't give much rational thought to what that truly meant until after utilizing deadly force as a response. Next, as we know, fibers from the broken paintbrush handle used to construct the garrote were found in the area of JonBenet's vagina, it's reasonable to think this was an attempt at mutilation, or at the very least, creating visible abrasions, and was not sexual in nature, certainly not in the context of a grown man seeking orgasm. And when the coroner found evidence of prior sexual abuse, it was not specified as being any different from what was caused during the crime. There's never a mention of intercourse, so we could assume the prior sexual abuse and that which was committed during the crime were similar, even if the crime was staged. And in that light, it seems Burke would be a likely suspect to have been the prior abuser for whom somebody was trying to cover, as mutilation of his sister's vagina, perhaps the quintessential representation of the female anatomy and beauty, would be entirely consistent with spreading feces all over her bedroom. His intent is to ruin the aesthetics of her perfect world, for two reasons. One, because it's all he can control. And two, because it's literally what he sees, and destroying the landscape to his satisfaction brings him instant gratification and attention from his parents, even if it's negative. Either way, we know this about the Ramseys' handling of their son, Burke. They were hiding something, something the grand jury later called, quote, child abuse, committed by somebody, quote, they assisted, end quote, in the murder of their daughter, an indication that they were not malicious, but intentionally neglectful in giving their help to the killer. Burke Ramsey was the only other person in the house that night. And the reason they wouldn't release his medical records is not because they were neglectful, but because they were aware. They had sought help, or at least understanding, from a medical professional. So the basis for this issue, the basis for why the Ramseys couldn't go to police and say it was an accident, is that those medical records would have revealed their inability to control Burke. And his loss of control is right at the heart of the matter. It's what caused the incident. And the best predictor of future behavior is past behavior. This is what they desperately wanted to hide, as the brutal 8.5-inch crack in that little girl's skull would ultimately tell the same story. Burke Ramsey lost control. In his 1997 interview with Dr. Suzanne Bernard, only a few weeks after JonBenet's death, Burke is asked to draw a picture of his family. While many find it confusing that he doesn't include JonBenet, she's already dead, so it isn't too surprising to me that he decides to exclude her. What catches my attention is that he fails to include his half-brother John Andrew or half-sister Melinda, both of whom had bedrooms in the Ramsey home on the same floor as Burke. The drawing only includes him, his mom, and his dad, which seems to explain the lack of emotion he feels at his sister's death, as noted by the doctor. The truth is, he's actually content at this point, almost disinterested, because the problem is gone. He really is at peace, and with his parents all to himself. And that's why I believe Burke Ramsey killed his sister JonBenet, to achieve that specific goal, one way or another. Of course, we'll probably never know what truly happened in the Ramsey home on Christmas night 1996. But I'll leave you with Burke's own words from that same interview with Suzanne Bernard. In it, the psychologist asks him if he has any secrets, to which Burke replies that he does. But if he told her, they wouldn't be secrets anymore. 20 years later, we're still wondering.